Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Today is the beginning of the transition to our new platform. We're going to be moving to a format that will allow us to have callers calling in. And this particular show has been pre-recorded with Andrew Sperling, whom I'm going to introduce to you in a minute. And later in the week, we're going to have a call-in version of this show where you'll be able to join us and be part of the conversation. So that'll be pretty exciting. And going forward, we are going to have a weekly call-in show where you'll be able to talk back to us. I'm getting a lot of questions about the new stimulus bill, or as it's now known, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. This is an incredible spending plan that's intended to revitalize our economy and also to be a shot in the arm to fix some problems that have gotten pretty bad and that are going to take some major investment in order to make a big dent in these problems. One of them is healthcare. And I like to say we have the best and the worst healthcare in the world. We certainly know that we have the best. If you are, God forbid, in an automobile accident and you're all cracked up, we have doctors who know how to put you back together and take good care of you in some pretty miraculous ways. So we have a very far advanced medical system in that respect. The problem is that 40% of Americans do not have access to that medical care. And if you don't have access, it's like standing at the bottom of a mountain and what you need is on the top and you can't get up the mountain. So it might as well not be there. It's at the other end of the universe. It is simply not available to you. And that's what we need to fix. We need to fix the access problem in the United States. And doctors are very much aware of this. Both of the political parties had something in their platforms about how to address the problem. And it's gotten to the point now where we must do something. So this act is trying to put some money in some very important places to make sure that we can modify access to care and quality of care. Those are the two major themes, access and quality. And so today we're going to talk about one of those components with Andrew Sperling. Andrew works for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He is a lobbyist in Washington. He is an attorney and a lobbyist in Washington who has been working very closely with this bill and with other acts in Washington, trying to make sure that the taxpayers' money is spent in the wisest possible way to improve access to care and quality of care for all Americans, and particularly for the population that he serves. So we're going to have a little station break here, as it were, a little word from our sponsor, the VHL Family Alliance, and then we'll be back to talk with Andrew. So stay with us, please, through this message, and we'll be right back.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
Welcome back. And now I'd like to introduce Andrew Sperling. Andrew, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
I'm Andrew Sperling. I'm the Director of Legislative Advocacy for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness. And you're also part of a consortium that's been working on comparative effectiveness research and other things to improve patient care, correct?
That's right, yes.
I think it's called the Partnership to Improve Patient Care.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about your efforts or the efforts of the consortium to improve patient care in Washington. Why Washington?
Well, it's in many cases, it's where our organizations are based. We tend to be heavily involved, some of us, in policy advocacy, which necessitates our being located in Washington, although NAMI as an organization has over 1,100 affiliates in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. So while our national office is here in Washington, we consider ourselves to be a broad-based grassroots organization and spread all across the country.
Right, but when we talk about improving patient care, we usually think about educating doctors. Why the government?
Well, because in this case, the government is stepping in to try and press for an agenda for research, and the government is, in this instance, investing over $1 billion in new research to try and discern of the available treatments out there for a particular chronic disease or health condition, which treatment works best. And we feel that patients need to be a part of that discussion with policymakers to make sure that not only is it good quality research, but we're actually asking questions that are relevant to patients and their families.
Right. Now, comparative effectiveness research, or CER, has become quite a hot potato lately in the press. Can you help us understand exactly what's being compared and who's doing it and how this might or might not result in legislation?
Well, actually, comparative effectiveness has been around for a while. Several institutes at the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, have been engaged in this kind of research and looking at existing treatments that exist that are available to patients to figure out not only which one works best, but which one works best for particular patient populations. Mm-hmm. And many of our organizations support this effort. And too often, doctors and patients are shooting in the dark about what treatment might work best for a particular individual patient, and we believe that institutions such as the NIH and the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality ought to be investing more in research to help guide clinical decision-making to reach the best outcomes and the best quality in our healthcare system.
Right, so this is not new. It's just getting a shot in the arm of additional funding.
That's correct. Now, what we're concerned about is that the governance of this research, how it's guided, how the priorities are set, and what's done with the research after it's done, is critically important. So we want to make sure that this $1.1 billion that's in President Obama's economic stimulus plan is spent most effectively to help doctors and patients make better decisions.
Right, because when you do a comparison, it's very important how you do the comparison. Like, so many clinical trials are set up to say, is this drug better than no treatment? Well, probably so, but is it better than other existing treatments? Is it better than taking an aspirin every day? Is it better than going to physical therapy? I mean, those seem to me to be really the questions.
That's absolutely correct, and it gets even more complex than that, because oftentimes when we're talking about comparative effectiveness research, we're not talking about one pill against another pill. We're actually talking about perhaps an intervention of medication therapy versus surgery, for example.
One of my favorite examples is that I have a cousin who lives in Sweden, and she, like me, is a 60-something lady and has been working on a farm all her life, and so her knees are not so great anymore. She actually has a prescription from her doctor to go 3 times a week to water aerobics at the local spa. Now, how many little old ladies could you send 3 times a week to water aerobics versus paying for one knee replacement? And it seems to me that's better for her all the way around, as long as it's, you know, it's containing her pain, and it's better for the healthcare system because they're not paying $100,000 for a knee replacement. So, you know, comparing effectiveness like that would be very helpful. How likely is it that we're going to get that as opposed to this appliance versus that appliance, or this knee replacement versus that drug?
We don't know yet. The bill just passed. It was signed into law by President Obama just 3 days ago. So we don't have all the answers yet. What we do know is that there are going to be several processes set up, and actually a government committee that's going to look at prioritizing the research. The Institute of Medicine is going to play a role in making recommendations to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So it's still very early to tell with this $1.1 billion. But what we do know, what we want to see, quite frankly, is research that's as comprehensive as possible, that's not just limited to just one drug versus another, but looking at across therapeutic areas. And we also want to make sure it's focusing on really where the costs are in our healthcare system, which by and large are with chronic diseases that guide as much as 70% of our national healthcare spending. We ought to look at where the big dollars are being spent in the healthcare system and look at the big question rather than just a narrow one drug versus another drug for a particular condition. The other thing I think that's critically important is the design of these studies. One of the things we know, one of the sort of dirty little secrets of research, whether it's sponsored by industry or whether it's sponsored by government, is that the populations that participate in these trials, by and large, are not as diverse as our country is. Right. So we know, for example, like across the NIH, the NIH is doing a lot to improve this, but to date, only about 2% of participants in NIH-sponsored clinical trials are representative of ethnic and racial minorities. So what we have is maybe a study, a well-designed study by an institute at NIH that has a population sample of as little as 500 people, with very little racial and ethnic diversity. So the problem is, right, if you take that and then make a decision about what therapies ought to be prescribed, it may tell you a lot about white males, but certainly not a lot about African-American women.
Right. I mean, it may not tell us much about women at all, and women are half the population before we even start talking about ethnic groups. Things are not always fairly designed.
Exactly right.
One of the other things that bothers me is that some of the clinical trials seem to me to be designed for the betterment of the drug. You know, they're designed so that the drug won't fail. And anybody who might get a bad result is eliminated from candidacy for being part of a clinical trial. So anybody who has disease that's more severe than a particular threshold, or if they have any other what they call comorbid condition, any other complicating factor that might make the data less clean or somehow be troubling to the success of this trial. And that, too, is a real problem, because once the drug comes on the market, all those people with all those complicating conditions are going to take this drug, and we don't know how they're going to fare on it. So you're quite right. It's not only just a matter of ethnicities. It's age groups, it's gender, and it's complicating conditions.
Joyce, you're exactly right. And some of NIH has made some progress in recent years to try and include people that had comorbid conditions to really look at treatment in real-world settings rather than that isolated individual that only has that condition, which, quite frankly, is rare in the healthcare system.
Yes. Oh, I have a high school friend who recently lost his son, his teenage son, and a mutual friend was telling me about this, and she said, this poor boy killed himself. He was 17 years old. He was under treatment for depression. They had him on antidepressant drugs. And I said, most antidepressant drugs, by the way, are not approved for kids under 24. So, you know, how do we make sure that even the things we do know about these drugs are in fact being listened to by the prescribers?
That's exactly right. And so one of the challenges we have, particularly with children and adolescents, is there are a tangle of ethical issues involved with consent for a child or adolescent participating in a clinical trial. Very difficult issues.
Right, but somehow we need to corral the learning together. I think one of the things that bothers me is this business of off-label use. Yes, the doctor ought to be able to prescribe a drug if he thinks that it might help this person and the person agrees. I agree with that. But somehow we need to collect that data. I think right now that data is totally lost. If somebody's taking, I don't know, Avastin for a condition for which it hasn't yet been approved, it's a new drug, it hasn't been tried for that. Okay, so it's fair to try it. But who's collecting that information? Who's finding out this worked or this didn't work?
Well, there's some new opportunities with the legislation reforming the FDA that was passed about 18 months ago to try and have more disclosure, more transparency, and get the FDA more involved in looking at essentially post-marketing reviews, where after medications have been approved, to make sure that we're doing a better job of tracking complications, other types of factors that come in after the medication goes on the market.
Right, and it's not just about medications. It's also about appliances. I mean, I read an article once that in most countries, especially where the healthcare systems are more uniformly administered, they are collecting data on the appliances that are installed. For example, if you get a knee replacement, there's actually this metal thing that's installed in your knee to be the replacement for that joint, and that's called an appliance. So if they use appliance A, they write this down in a little database, and then 6 months from now, if that person has some complication, they also make a note of that so that they track which appliances seem to work out better than others. And we are using in the United States some of those appliances that have been banned in the UK for 2 years. We don't even collect the data in any kind of organized way. And so we really don't have that perspective. What's the success rate? How many people wound up having to have this removed 6 months later?
Yeah, but we ought to be careful to make sure that we don't get involved in using this data to completely remove products from the market, because remember, when we're talking about the average patient, there are going to be outliers for which that particular device may only work for a small group of individuals, and some of it, you know, there's important implications for saying, well, because one might work better than the other in the average patient, we're going to completely remove it from the market and deny access for people for whom that particular therapy is the only thing that's going to work.
True, but we do need to keep track of that. There was a very high rate of complications, like some sort of an infection, for example, very high rate of infection from this particular appliance, and at least investigate that and find out, was that being done in a practice where good procedures were not being followed, or was that because of something innate in the appliance itself?
Absolutely. That data needs to be collected, and comparative effectiveness can help do that, but at least in the case of the new FDA, it's not that new, it's now 18 months old, but the changes that Congress made with the FDA a few years ago is going to allow for much more aggressive post-marketing review, not just of medications, but also medical devices.
Fascinating stuff. And if you'd like to have a conversation with us about this topic, we're going to have some experts visiting with us later in this week. We don't have the final scheduling information yet, so if you would, please write to questions@powerfulpatient.org. We will send you the time, and we hope that you'll be able to join us. Actually, you may be able to help us determine the time, depending on your own availability. So do write to questions@powerfulpatient.org, and we will be glad to include you in the conversation if at all possible. So we're going to take a little break here, and we'll be right back after this message to talk some more with Andrew Sperling.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back, and we're speaking with Andrew Sperling of the National Association on Mental Illness about comparative effectiveness research. And it's always important to know who is doing the study and what their motivations might be.
For example, there's a breakfast cereal out that says we compared the effectiveness of having our wonderful sugared breakfast cereal for breakfast as opposed to children who had no breakfast, and the kids who ate our cereal were much more attentive in class and got better grades. Okay, well, that's a little bit biased. If you look just at your one product versus no breakfast, almost anything is going to win. But did you look at it versus the unsugared version of your own product or versus having eggs for breakfast? We need to make sure that these are fair comparisons that are meaningful to us in some really effective way.
I think you're right, Joyce, and I think what's critical is looking at the design of the study. And that's where, quite frankly, we want to make sure that patient organizations and patient advocacy groups have input into the structure by which the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the NIH director and the director of what's called AHRQ, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, are going to be designing these, the standards that the people that carry out these studies, whether in academia or in government, are going to, the standards by which these studies will be conducted and disseminated.
So currently, when there's a clinical trial, it's designed by the physician in charge of the clinical trial in concert with the drug company, right?
Well, not necessarily. These will be purely government-funded studies. There will not be industry resources will not be guiding these studies. This is $1.1 billion, exclusively government public money. And while there will be standards developed by the Department of Health and Human Services and the NIH, it will be, in most cases, the lead investigator, who's generally from academia, although it could be other types of private foundations, how they will be designing the study and making sure it meets applicable standards. And they'll have to go through the traditional institutional review board process to make sure that there's full consent for people who agree to participate in these types of trials. But what we won't have with this is the taint or suspicion that of industry resources guiding it, because this is $1.1 billion of public money, not industry money.
Okay, but what I was leading up to is how will consumer groups have a voice in the design of these trials?
That we don't know yet, and that we're going to be working on lobbying the new Health and Human Services Secretary when he or she is named, and the NIH director and the AHRQ director to make sure we have input into that. And also the Institute of Medicine, they're going to play a critical role in developing priority setting for this. So we're going to be working with the IOM on that as well.
Great. So now that we actually have something on the books, we have a law on the books, there's still some rulemaking and design yet to be had, right?
That's correct.
And how does someone get a voice into that project, into that process? By contacting you or the PIPC, or what's the best way to try to speak up and be heard here?
Well, contacting PIPC would be a place to start, although we're not going to be in control of this. I think, quite frankly, we expect at some point the Department of Health and Human Services to issue guidelines on this. There's actually specific timelines that Congress set forth in terms of implementing this, and reports that have to go to Congress and to the President on progress in implementing this. So that's one potential area. We suspect, although we don't know, that when the IOM issues its report, that they will actually publish that on the Internet and have the opportunity for public comment.
Right. So maybe contact your representatives, your senator and representatives for your particular geographic area, and maybe talk to their health staffer and try to make sure that you get information as close to the process as possible.
Absolutely. That would be one way to do it, and I think the IOM as well, the Institute of Medicine.
The Institute of Medicine, and there's a website for that. I can put that in the handout that goes with the show. But is there any particular person who's heading up that charge?
We don't know yet. And in fact, it actually says, I think within 30 days or 60 days, the the Secretary of Health and Human Services is to contract with the IOM. So the contract with IOM to do this work has not even been initiated yet.
Okay. So the process is first we need a new head for the Department of Health and Human Services, and then a contract with the Institute of Medicine, and then things will begin to emerge in the public. But there's going to be opportunity for public comment here, right?
We hope. Now, there's also a 15-member federal coordinating council for comparative effectiveness research. We don't know that much about this. What we do know is that it will be exclusively representatives from within federal agencies, say from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the NIH, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Various federal agencies are going to have representatives on this 15-member council, but what we don't know is whether that council is going to be required to meet in public, to have their meetings be part of a public record and offer the public the opportunity to comment. And that's going to be the first thing that's going to happen. That's within a month that's going to happen. And then by June, the Secretary is supposed to contract with the IOM for recommendations on national priorities.
Right, but there is a trend toward making sure that there is at least some input from consumer advocates and consumer advocacy groups, right?
Most definitely. I would note, you know, President Obama has set forth very high standards for all of the money in this $787 billion economic recovery package for transparency and openness. There's going to be a website that's set up for all of that, but we certainly hope that this comparative effectiveness research adheres to those standards of transparency and full input from the public.
Right. So the healthcare staffer for your representatives in Washington should be able to keep you fairly apprised of how to go about staying in tune with that, at least reading what's said on the internet and possibly being part of one of those committees.
Yes.
Right. So you want this for the NAMI, National Association for Mental Illness, and you have other colleagues in Washington that you're working with?
Most definitely, from organizations such as the Epilepsy Foundation, the Friends of Cancer Research, the Alliance for Hispanic Health. We have a whole broad coalition of disease and patient advocacy groups that work in coalition together to make sure that this is done the right way.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your efforts, and it's wonderful to have you advocating for all of us there. And is there any other suggestion that you would have for how people can support you in your work and hopefully contribute their thinking to it? I'm concerned with all the flame-throwing that's going on in the press, which is totally non-productive. We need to somehow cut through to the real issues here and give real input at the right places.
Yeah, I think keeping your members of Congress informed would be critically important. And once we know more about how this is going to go forward, particularly the report from the Institute of Medicine, I think having the public comment on that and the need to make sure this is that comparative effectiveness research is oriented toward improving quality and improving patient outcomes and not solely cost effectiveness. This ought not to be a race to the bottom, just to invest in research to find cheaper treatments. It ought to be investment toward better treatment.
Exactly. It's not all about cost by any means. But, for example, if someone receives a treatment and then subsequently has an infection and has to go in and have a subsequent treatment, there's not only a financial cost in there, there's a huge human cost. And it could mean that this person has some ongoing disability that comes out of this. Certainly they've lost a big chunk of their life and their ability to get back to work on time. So there's a huge human cost in here that we're trying to improve. The quality and the patient outcome are not just about dollars. They're, in fact, about improving the quality of your life.
I completely agree.
Great. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to leave with our listeners before we go?
No, just join NAMI and other patient groups in making sure that we're about improving quality.
Great. Thank you so much, Andrew. Appreciate
thank you.
Time.
And thank you for being with us today. It's really been great to have you here. And when we can talk back to one another, it'll be even more exciting. So Going forward with Powerful Patient, you will have one more choice than you currently have. You will still be able to access this program on demand at powerfulpatient.org as you have been doing. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast. And the third option is, if you would like to be part of the conversation, you can dial in for the live taping of the show, for the recording of the show originally, and be part of that conversation. Add your questions into the conversation with us. And once that show has been recorded, then it would be available on demand and as a podcast. So watch for new happenings at powerfulpatient.org. As we said, the show is just now coming together in its new slot. We're still devising what's the right time to have the live broadcast so that the maximum number of people can join us. And if you would like to help us nail that down, please do send us your thoughts and opinions on the matter at questions@powerfulpatient.org. Don't forget to pick up the handout that goes with this show, which is also at powerfulpatient.org, and look for the interview with Andrew Sperling and the handout that goes with it. We're very excited about the new format and hope that you will join us, as always, next week on your choice of those options. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.